Have you ever been hit by a sound? I mean, not just heard it, but really felt it, like deep in your bones, a riff maybe, or a voice, a rhythm that just grabs you and changes how you think about music, that kind of spark.
Well, it often comes from one person's fearless vision. Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're doing a deep dive into the life and legacy of a man whose ear for talent and just his audacious spirit didn't just tweak the sound of the 20th century, nope. Utterly reshaped it. We're talking about Samuel Cornelius Phillips, the legend, you know, known simply as Sam Phillips.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here, I think, is how one individual, right, coming from seemingly a pretty unassuming beginnings, how he could cultivate such a profound understanding of human emotion, of cultural currents. He wasn't just creating music. He created this unique space where groundbreaking art could actually emerge. He was kind of a midwife, you could say, to a whole cultural revolution.
A midwife. I like that.
Yeah. It's a story that fundamentally changed not just what we listen to, but how we listen. And maybe most importantly, who gets to make those sounds heard in the first place? Absolutely. And when you think about it, so many sounds that define whole genres. Rock and roll, obviously, rockabilly, classic R&B, even bits of country and blues. You can trace their lineage directly back to this one guy. He was like the sonic alchemist, right?
Yeah.
The talent whisperer, the visionary who dared to record the sounds nobody else was touching.
Mm-hmm.
So our mission today is really to discover those specific nuggets of insight that turned Sam Phillips into a legend. We're talking the pivotal decisions, the philosophies underneath it all, and those, you know, aha moments that weren't just about hitting the right note, but about reshaping an entire era and ultimately our shared musical landscape. So let's journey back, way back to the beginning, right? And understand the formative influences that shaped this visionary. Sam Phillips was born January 5th, 1923, youngest of eight kids, believe it or not, on a 200-acre mortgage farm near Florence, Alabama. His parents, Madge Ella and Charles Tucker Phillips, gave him this connection to the land, but also, crucially, to the sounds that came from it.
Right. And that early environment.
Yeah.
It was much more than just a place he was born. It was really a crucible of experience that profoundly impacted young Sam. You have to picture this. A young boy spending countless hours picking cotton. Alabama heat, you know. And not alone, but alongside black laborers.
Right.
Now, this wasn't just physical work. It was this immersive cultural exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Phillips himself, he explicitly recalled how hearing these laborers singing, you know, chanting, humming spirituals, field hollers right there in the fields, it left this indelible, profound impression on him.
Wow.
It wasn't like he was just casually observing from the outside. No, it was deeply personal, foundational. It just permeated his whole worldview.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't just hearing tunes. He was absorbing this raw, authentic expression of life, of burden, joy, hope, all woven into the fabric of daily struggle. And that exposure to such unvarnished, heartfelt music, it really laid the essential groundwork for his later musical taste, his openness to diverse, unpolished sounds.
That's where it gets really interesting, isn't it? So you've got this young man steeped in these powerful, raw sounds of the rural South, but he's dreaming of something totally different for himself, at first anyway. Before music really took over his path, Phillips had these distinct academic aspirations. He even conducted the school band at Coffee High School, which, okay, shows an early inclination towards structure, maybe leadership, a creative side.
Sure.
But his ambition was bigger than the bandstand. He wanted to be a criminal defense attorney. What does that tell us about his character, maybe even before music became his calling?
That's an excellent question.
Yeah.
Because it gives us this crucial window into his core identity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Wanting to be a criminal defense attorney. It suggests a mind already leaning towards structure, yes, but also a really deep-seated sense of justice and a desire to advocate for people whose voices might otherwise be unheard or misrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
He was sort of drawn, really, to the idea of giving agency a platform to the marginalized, which, when you think about it, it's not actually that far removed from what he ended up doing in music, is it?
Huh, good point.
That desire for justice, that early exposure to authentic voices often overlooked by the mainstream, it all kind of converges. But then life threw him that curveball you mentioned, the harsh realities of the Great Depression. They forced this major shift. His father went bankrupt and then sadly died in 1941. Sam had to leave high school early. Just 18 years old. Suddenly, he's responsible for his mother and aunt. He's working tough jobs, grocery store, even a funeral parlor.
Wow, a funeral parlor.
Yeah, it really underscores that early sense of responsibility, his resilience. He had to confront life and death, joy and sorrow up close. And that would undoubtedly resonate later in the kind of soulful, raw music he wanted to produce.
So after those really formative years in Alabama, there's this pivotal personal connection, right? And a crucial professional insight. They kind of intertwine and set the stage. He starts his radio career at WLA, that's AM, in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. This is the 1940s. He's working as a DJ, a radio engineer. And it's there, 1942, that Sam, who's only 19, meets Rebecca, Becky Burns. She's just 17, still in high school. But she's already a local radio personality with her sister. They were the Kitchen Sisters.
It's a truly charming story, almost cinematic, isn't it, for his most significant personal relationship. Phillips himself, he recounted it with real warmth, saying, "I fell in love with Becky's voice even before I met her." And Becky, in recollections she shared later, painted this incredibly vivid picture of their first meeting, described him coming in out of the rain, hair all windblown, raindrops in it. She remembered his sandals and a smile unlike any I had ever seen. And famously, she told her family that very night after he sat on the piano bench and talked to her, she said, "I had met the man I wanted to marry."
Wow. Just like that.
Just like that. They married in 1943, had two kids. They did eventually divorce in 1960, but that connection clearly ran deep. Becky passed away in 2012, aged 87. It was just an essential part of his early adult life, you know, a kind of human anchor during this intense period of growth for him, personally and professionally.
And beyond that really deep personal connection, WLA also gave him this crucial professional insight, something that would directly fuel his future work. He explicitly said that the station's open format, meaning they played music by both white and black musicians, that would later inspire his work in Memphis. So this open format idea, what does it really tell us about the kind of producer he was already becoming, especially thinking about the segregated South back then? It wasn't just playing diverse music. It was kind of barrier breaking from the start, right?
Oh, absolutely critical point.
Yeah.
Because that experience at WLA, it was genuinely foundational to his whole philosophy. In an era when racial segregation was just rigidly enforced everywhere, especially in media like radio, Phillips wasn't just exposed to, but actively participated in, a broadcasting environment that transcended those racial lines in its music.
Right.
This wasn't just some progressive idea he read about. It was a practical, daily demonstration that different musical traditions could coexist. And not only coexist, but appeal powerfully to diverse audiences. It really solidified his belief in the universal power of authentic music, regardless of the performer's race. It showed him firsthand that there was a hungry audience for sounds that didn't fit neatly into the racial boxes of the time.
So he saw the market, too.
He saw the market, and he felt the power of the music. This early exposure to a non-segregated soundscape, it deeply informed his later vision for Sun Records. That's where he'd intentionally try to bridge those cultural divides.
Mm-hmm.
After WA, he moves to Memphis, which is this vibrant cultural melting pot itself, right? He worked there from 45 to 49 as an announcer, sound engineer for WREC. And that period, it further honed his technical skills, deepened his understanding of the city's unique musical pulse, and brought him even closer to that incredible confluence of blues, country, gospel that was just simmering in Memphis.
And that very pulse, that intoxicating mix of sounds, it leads directly to his next big audacious move. January 3rd, 1950. Phillips takes the leap, opens the Memphis Recording Service, 706 Union Avenue, Memphis. And this wasn't initially some grand record label with big backers, was it? It was simpler, more accessible, almost like a community hub for sound.
Yeah, this is really where we start to see Phillips' genius for creating an environment of possibility, a space where raw talent felt, I don't know, safe, encouraged. The initial function of the Memphis Recording Service, it was remarkably democratic for the time. It let anyone, particularly amateurs, record. You could literally walk in off Union Avenue, paid a few bucks, and cut your voice, your band, onto an acetate disc.
Wow, like a photo booth for sound.
Kind of. And it was such a stark contrast to the rigid, often exclusive major labels who were the gatekeepers, right?
Mm.
Phillips was about opening doors, not slamming them shut. And through those very doors walked some absolute legends, often before anyone else knew their names. Artists like B.B. King, Junior Parker, the electrifying Howlin' Wolf.
Howlin' Wolf, unbelievable.
Many of them black blues musicians, often ignored by the bigger white-dominated labels. They made some of their very first seminal recordings right there. And Phillips, he wouldn't just keep these recordings. He'd license them, sell them to larger labels, like Chess Records up in Chicago. So he was effectively acting as this pioneering talent scout and a vital, almost essential bridge between raw, untapped talent and the mainstream music industry. He was enabling voices that otherwise might never have been heard outside their local communities, amplifying sounds bubbling up from the cultural underground.
And it was right there, at the Memphis Recording Service that a sound was forged that many music historians, people like Peter Gromick, consider the first rock and roll record. We're talking Rocket 88 by Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats, which was actually a band led by a 19-year-old Ike Turner. He wrote the song too, recorded in 51, eventually released by Chess in Chicago.
Oh, the significance of Rocket 88. You just can't overstate it. Not just as, like, a historical marker, but as a genuine blueprint for a complete new sound. It wasn't just another song, it was a sonic manifesto. It showcased Phillips' unique ability to capture and amplify this raw, energetic musical style that just actively defied easy categories. That driving rhythm, the deliberately distorted guitar, legend has it, came from a damaged amplifier being pushed way too hard.
Ah, the mistake becoming the magic.
Exactly. It was rough, it was wild, and it was undeniably new. It encapsulated the very essence of what rock and roll would become. You know, a blend of blues, R&B, and this fresh, youthful energy. This wasn't polished pop, sanitized for the masses. This was visceral, authentic, bursting with life, perfectly aligned with Phillips' whole philosophy of capturing feel over technical perfection.
Can you just imagine being in that studio? Maybe smelling the cigarette smoke, I don't know, hearing Rocket 88 for the very first time. It wasn't just a song, it was like a seismic shift, wasn't it? Becoming rock and roll, rattling the foundations of everything, echoing through decades. And it wasn't a fluke or a one-off. From 1950 to 54, Philton kept recording this incredibly wide range of artists from all across the Southern musical spectrum. We're talking James Cotton, Rufus Thomas, Roscoe Gordon, Little Milton, Bobby Blue Bland, even The Prisoners, that vocal group from the state penitentiary.
Right, The Prisoners, incredible story there too.
It just shows the amazing breadth of his early work, his commitment to diverse sounds. Way before he even launched his own label, he was clearly building something, wasn't he? An empire of raw sound. So with the success, the growing reputation of the Memphis Recording Service, it was really only a matter of time before Sam Phillips decided, okay, I need to put my own stamp on this music. So 1952, Phillips officially launches his own label, the Sun Record Company, using that same studio, 706 Union Avenue, as its beating heart.
Yeah, that was a truly pivotal moment. A conscious decision, really, to move beyond just being a talent scout and become the creator of his own destiny. And the impact, staggering. During its relatively short but incredibly explosive 16-year run, Sun Records produced something like 226 singles, yielding more raw, authentic rock and roll records than pretty much any other label of its time.
That's insane for an indie label.
It's a staggering output. For an independent label run by just a handful of people, minimal resources. But Phillips wasn't just interested in churning out hits for hit's sake. He had this profound, almost revolutionary philosophy behind his label. He articulated his goals really clearly. He said he wanted to, quote, develop new and different artists and get some freedom in music and tap some resources and people that weren't being tapped.
Freedom in music.
Exactly. This was a radical departure from the commercial norms back then, which often prioritized established artists, formulaic sounds, rigid genre boundaries. Phillips's approach, it was about democratizing music, giving a platform, a voice, an audience to the unheard. He was seeking out the authentic, the raw, the unvarnished truth in sound wherever he found it.
And central to that almost spiritual approach was his unique way of capturing sound, his specific production philosophy. He famously said, and it's the quote that defines him really, he didn't care about mistakes, he cared about the feel. That statement is just absolutely central to understanding his whole production style and why Sun Records sounded so incredibly authentic, so raw, so utterly alive. It wasn't about polished perfection, which every other major label was gunning for. It was about capturing the essence, the raw emotion, the undeniable vibe of a performance, even if it meant embracing the rough edges.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture of music production, Phillips wasn't just running a business. He was acting like a kind of cultural alchemist. Seeking out and amplifying voices that were authentic, resonant, often from communities that had been marginalized or just ignored by the mainstream. His focus on feel over mistakes, it completely inverted the traditional recording paradigm. While other producers might spend hours, you know, endless retakes to fix a vocal wobble, a missed chord, a slight timing thing, Phillips understood something profound. Those very imperfections often contained the raw humanity, the spontaneous energy, the emotional truth that made a performance real and compelling.
Yeah.
Imagine a band, right? Maybe a little nervous, maybe a bit off key for a second, but playing with incredible passion. Another producer, stop tape, Phillips, let the tape roll, because he was listening for the fire, the spirit. He saw beauty in the unpolished, the raw, the genuine expression. because he knew that's where the heart of the music truly resided. He was recording moments, not just notes on a page.
This quest for a raw authenticity also deeply rooted him in a particular genre, the blues. While Phillips recorded loads of different styles at Sun Country, rockabilly, gospel, kishville, he had this particular profound interest in the blues. He really got what that music meant, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. His connection to the blues, it went way beyond just musical appreciation.
Yeah.
It was deeply empathetic, profoundly intellectual. He articulated his understanding of it with remarkable clarity. He said, "The blues, it got people black and white to think about life, how difficult, yet also how good it can be. They would sing about it, they would pray about it, they would preach about it. This is how they relieved the burden of what existed day in and day out."
Wow, that's powerful.
Isn't it? It just reveals his deep understanding and appreciation for the genre's emotional depth, its philosophical weight, its vital social function as this form of communal therapy and expression. For Phillips, the blues wasn't just entertainment. It was a spiritual release, a powerful narrative of human experience, and this passion for the blues, this innate understanding of its raw power. It formed a fundamental foundation for the rock and roll sound he would cultivate. It showcased the genre's profound influence on the raw energy, the storytelling, the absolute authenticity he sought in all his recordings, bridging gaps, you know, sacred and secular, country and city.
So the blues wasn't just a musical style for him. It was this profound human expression, a way to relieve the burden, like a kind of emotional, spiritual release valve. That's such a powerful insight into his motivations, the underlying mission of Sun Records. And it brings us directly to a moment that would forever change music history, the discovery of a then unknown truck driver named Elvis Presley.
Indeed. It's a story that's been told so many times, but its significance just never diminishes, does it? July 18th, 1953. An 18-year-old Elvis Presley, working as a truck driver for Crown Electric, walks into the Memphis Recording Service studio. Now, he wasn't there to audition for a record deal, not initially. He just wanted to record an acetate disc, a personal record. Maybe as a gift for his mother, Gladys, who he adored.
Right, the story goes it was for his mom.
Exactly. And crucially, Phillips himself didn't actually meet Presley on this first visit. It was through the keen ear, the mediation, of Marion Kiesker. She was a longtime collaborator at the studio, a well-known Memphis radio personality. She's the one who first truly recognized Presley's talent. Kiesker heard something utterly unique, compelling in Elvis's voice and delivery as he sang "My Happiness" and "That's When Your Heartaches Begin." She turned on the tape recorder during a session. She later played it for Phillips. And it was really Kiesker's persistent encouragement, her belief in Elvis, that gradually, crucially, warmed Phillips to the idea of recording him professionally. She saw something special that Phillips maybe initially missed.
What incredible serendipity, but also human perception, right? A truck driver walks in, the boss doesn't immediately see it, but history gets made anyway, thanks to Marion Kiesker's ear and Phillips's eventual vision. But like you said, he wasn't immediately blown away. What was his initial reaction, and how did that evolve into launching Elvis's career?
Well, that's the fascinating part. Phillips wasn't immediately impressed during Presley's actual audition in 54, even after Kiesker kept prompting him. Elvis sang a few country ballads, you know, and while his voice was good, sure, didn't ignite that unique spark, Phillips was always searching for that raw, unpolished feel. It wasn't until Phillips, maybe a bit frustrated, asked him what else he could sing. And Elvis launched into this impromptu, incredibly energetic, deeply rhythmic version of Arthur Big Boy Kudup's blues standard, "That's All Right, Mama."
Ah, the magic moment.
That was the catalyst. It was just raw, energetic. It resonated deeply with Phillips's desire for authenticity, his understanding of the blues power. He immediately got its potential, unprecedented potential. He famously called up Dewey Phillips, no relation, the DJ at WHBQ 560, played the song on his hugely popular Red Hot and Blue program, and boom, Elvis's regional career basically launched overnight.
Just like that.
And here's that interesting fact again, highlighting the weird alchemy of early rock and roll for the first 6 months or so. The flip side of that single Blue Moon of Kentucky, which was Presley's incredibly upbeat, almost frantic version of a Bill Monroe bluegrass song, was actually slightly more popular than "That's All Right, Mama."
No kidding, the bluegrass side.
Yeah. It just showed how these diverse, seemingly separate influences could merge into something totally new and captivating, hitting different audiences in different ways.
That's truly fascinating. It really speaks to Phillips's patience, his vision, and yeah, Marion Kiesker's crucial ear, seeing something beyond the obvious, beyond convention. But once he did recognize that raw talent in Elvis, how did he know what to do with it? How did he steer him away from just being another country crooner towards this entirely new explosive sound, the sound that became rock and roll?
Phillips had this almost unparalleled intuition. For artistic direction, yes, but also for market potential. He absolutely saw that Elvis could tear a ballad to pieces. He knew Elvis had this beautiful crooning voice, could captivate with traditional country or pop. But Phillips actively, and quite deliberately, guided him away from that safer, more predictable path. He famously told Elvis, and recalled later, "If I had released a ballad, I don't think you would have heard of Elvis Presley."
Wow, that's definitive.
It was a conscious, strategic decision. Push boundaries, create something truly new, rather than just polish existing forms or try to fit Elvis into some predetermined genre box. He recognized Elvis's unique power lay in that electrifying fusion. Country, blues, gospel, delivered with unprecedented energy, a rebellious charisma, and undeniable, well, magnetism that nobody else had harnessed like that before. And while Elvis wasn't yet nationally known, his regional singles, his growing success, it became this irresistible magnet for Sun Records. Suddenly, aspiring singers from all across the South were flocking there, hoping to find their own Sam Phillips, their own path to that authentic sound.
And attract them he did. Phillips' pivotal role in early rock and roll, maybe most famously exemplified by that legendary, almost mythical, million-dollar quartet jam session. Mm-hmm. December 4th, 1956. You know, you just picture it in your mind and it still sends shivers down your spine, doesn't it?
Oh, it's an iconic scene. Perfectly encapsulates the spontaneous magic Phillips could conjure at Sun Studio. Picture this. Jerry Lee Lewis, right? The Killer. He's in the studio, pounding away at the piano, backing up Carl Perkins on a recording session. Suddenly, completely unexpectedly, Elvis Presley walks in. He's already a massive national sensation by this point, just dropping by to visit.
Just casually pops in.
Right. And Phillips, ever the impresario, doesn't hesitate. Picks up the phone, calls Johnny Cash, who's performing nearby, tells him, get down here. Mm. And this leads to this entirely impromptu, unscripted jam session featuring these four legends, Elvis, Cash, Perkins, Lewis. Imagine the energy, the raw talent, just converging by sheer chance, and Phillips' quick thinking to capture it on tape. It wasn't about perfection. It was about the confluence of these titanic personalities, their shared love of music.
Imagine being a fly on the wall for that session. The sheer unadulterated talent, the serendipity, it's legendary. And it speaks volumes about the incredibly creative, spontaneous, almost like a family environment Phillips fostered there. And he even added a bit of his signature showmanship to motivate his artists, right?
Always pushing.
She absolutely did. Phillips wasn't just a producer. He was a master motivator, a cheerleader. And yeah, a shrewd businessman all rolled into one. He challenged the four of them, the quartet, to achieve gold record sales, offered a very tempting prize, a free Cadillac to the first one to hit that milestone.
Cadillac. Nice. Yeah. It was this spirited, competitive, but ultimately friendly contest, which Carl Perkins, the rockabilly pioneer, ultimately won. And this legendary contest, it's even commemorated in a song by the Drive-By Truckers, shows how deeply ingrained these stories are in American music lore, you know? And beyond Elvis and the Million Dollar Quartet, Phillips's discerning ear, his daring vision, it extended to launching other huge stars at Sun. We're talking artists like the operatic Roy Orbison.
Orbison, incredible voice.
The high-energy Sonny Burgess with his hit My Bucket's Got a Hole in It. The smooth stylings of Charlie Rich.
Yeah.
Bluesman Junior Parker.
Mm-hmm.
The rockabilly wildman Billy Lee Riley. Each of these artists, they contributed significantly to the rich, distinctive tapestry of the Sun record sound, all brought to the forefront by Sam Phillips.
Sam Phillips wasn't just a record producer, though. He was an innovator, a talent scout, and maybe most profoundly, a quiet social pioneer. He was this relentless advocate for racial equality, helping to fundamentally break down racial barriers in the music industry. During a time when America, especially the South, was just deeply, rigidly segregated.
Yeah, this aspect of Phillips's legacy is, without a doubt, one of his most significant contributions.
Hmm.
And yet, it's often underappreciated, isn't it? His commitment to racial equality, it wasn't just some convenient business strategy or a political stance he adopted. It was deeply ingrained in his fundamental life experience, his core musical philosophy. We can trace it right back to those earliest memories, picking cotton alongside black laborers in Alabama, and his subsequent experience with that open format at WLA Radio, which fearlessly played music by both white and black musicians.
Right. It was baked in early.
It was baked in. Those experiences taught him firsthand the universal appeal of authentic, heartfelt music, showed him its power to transcend these artificial racial divides. He saw that music, at its purest, was colorblind.
So this wasn't just a business decision for him, like, oh, here's an untapped market. It was a core belief system, driven by his personal history, what he'd seen. But how did that actually translate into his work at Sun Records? In the deeply segregated South of the 1950s, what were the challenges? How did he navigate that?
It was revolutionary. and frankly, pretty risky. In the 1950s South, social interaction between black and white people was severely restricted. Cultural products, strictly segregated. Phillips consciously created Sun Studio as one of the very few places where black and white musicians could freely interact, collaborate, create together. This wasn't just tolerated, it was encouraged. He wasn't just recording black artists like B.B. King, Howlin' Wolf, Junior Parker. He was actively, often aggressively, finding ways to sell their music to a broader audience, including white listeners.
How did he do that?
By licensing their tracks to larger labels, promoting them on radio, and crucially, by presenting artists like Elvis Presley as a fusion of these black and white musical traditions. Elvis wasn't just a white singer. He was a white singer singing black blues music, often in a style undeniably influenced by the R&B artists Phillips had recorded. This was groundbreaking, a direct challenge to the racial rules of the time. Phillips used his studio as this literal and figurative space for cultural connection to happen, long before it was socially comfortable or widely accepted. He didn't just record music. He amplified a message of unity through sound, paving the way for a more integrated musical landscape. It was a profound act of cultural integration through art, often facing pushback, implicit or explicit, from a society not ready for that kind of blending.
And his profoundly progressive thinking, it wasn't just confined to the studio walls or the music genres he recorded. Phillips also launched radio station Where, October 29th, 1955. And this was genuinely audacious, even for him, for its time. Can you tell us more about this incredible venture?
Absolutely. Where was just an incredible testament to Phillips's innovative spirit, his willingness to challenge societal norms. It was the first all-female radio station in the entire United States. Think about that. 1955, an era when women's roles in professional life were highly restricted. Phillips builds a station where almost every single position, on-air announcers, engineers, sales, admin staff, almost every job was held by a woman.
That's amazing.
It was virtually unheard of. Deeply progressive. And there's this interesting, almost humorous twist. Each of the young women who auditioned, they initially assumed there'd only be one female announcer position, right? As was standard kind of tokenistic practice back then. They only learned about the radical all-female format days before the first broadcast. Must have been a shock and an exhilarating one. This wasn't just a business venture. It was a social statement, demonstrating Phillips's innovative approach, not just in music, but in broader media, employment practices. He was constantly thinking outside the box, seeing talent and potential where others just saw traditional boundaries.
An all-female radio station in 1955, that's genuinely audacious. It speaks to the streak of progressive thinking that went way beyond just music, right into social equity. But Phillips wasn't just a creative visionary and social pioneer. He was also a remarkably shrewd businessman, able to parlay those initial successes into a significant financial empire.
Yeah, this really highlights Phillips's comprehensive vision, his multifaceted genius. He wasn't just a creative artist, a sonic genius. He was an astute entrepreneur who understood how to build an empire that stretched far beyond the recording studio, solidifying his financial independence and, importantly, his ongoing influence. Through a series of incredibly shrewd investments, he amassed a significant personal fortune. A prime example, and one that really showcases his remarkable foresight, is his early investment in Holiday Inn.
Holiday Inn, really?
Really. He became one of the very first investors in that burgeoning motel chain. Shortly after making one of his most famous business decisions, selling Elvis Presley's contract to RCA, which was then a groundbreaking $35,000.
Huge money back then.
Huge money. But he didn't just pocket it. He invested it wisely. He multiplied that initial sum many, many times over through his Holiday Inn shares. It shows this almost uncanny foresight into the rapidly expanding travel and hospitality industry in post-war America. He understood America was hitting the road and travelers needed places to stay.
That's truly incredible business acumen. He didn't just get the nuances of a great vocal or a killer guitar riff. He understood opportunity and, crucially, how to leverage success into totally new ventures. What other ventures did he pursue that paint this picture, this multifaceted entrepreneur?
Oh, his business interests were incredibly diverse, showcased a constant drive to innovate and expand. He created two subsidiary recording labels, Phillips International Records, which kept fostering new talent, and Holiday Inn Records, actually capitalizing on his hospitality investment. Very clever. He also ventured into the restaurant business, owned the Sun Studio Cafe in Memphis, one location was notably inside the Big Ball of Memphis. Further expanding his media empire beyond just music, Phillips founded Big River Broadcasting Corporation, which to this day owns and operates several radio stations back in his home area, Florence, Alabama. WQLT-FM, WSBM, WXFL, even established another radio station, WLIZ, down in Lake Worth, Florida, back in 1959. It paints his picture of a man who, having carved out his niche in music, wasn't content to just rest on his laurels. He constantly sought new avenues for growth, for influence, building on his initial success in music to create this truly diversified empire. He was a master at identifying trends early and planting seeds for future growth.
So, by the mid-1960s, Phillips is rarely recording new stuff himself. The original Sun Studios' prominence as a hitmaker kind of waned as the music landscape shifted. He built a satellite studio, kept expanding his radio ventures, but he eventually sold some records to Shelby Singleton in 1969. But his sons, Knox and Jerry, they carried on the legacy, right? Notably working at Phillips' recording studio in 77. And Sam even joined them to oversee recordings on John Prine's album Pink Cadillac. So his direct involvement lessened, maybe, but his influence, obviously, never faded.
Never faded. And that enduring influence, it's reflected in the sheer volume and diversity of his accolades. His impact was just so vast, transcending specific genres like rock and roll to touch blues, country, even pop.
Yeah.
It's evidenced by his numerous prestigious awards. He was rightfully part of that inaugural group inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1986, and notably, the very first non-performer to get that honor.
First non-performer. That says it all.
It really does. A powerful testament to his behind-the-scenes genius. He's also recognized by the Rockabilly Hall of Fame, the Alabama Music Hall of Fame, 87. Got a Grammy Trustees Award for Lifetime Achievement in 91, acknowledging his profound, decades-long contributions, his deep impact on the blues community. Recognized with his induction into the Blues Hall of Fame in 98, and in 2001, he joined the esteemed Country Music Hall of Fame. Most recently, part of the inaugural class of the Memphis Music Hall of Fame in 2012. These aren't just awards. They're like a mosaic demonstrating his unparalleled cross-genre legacy.
It's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it, that he was the first non-performer in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame truly underscores that foundational, almost architectural role he played in building that whole genre. And his larger-than-life story, his incredibly unique character, it's even captured the imagination of Hollywood. Various portrayals over the years, Charles Cyphers back in 79 in Elvis, Dallas Roberts in Walk the Line, and there's even the exciting announcement that Leonardo DiCaprio is set to portray him in a forthcoming film.
Right, that'll be interesting to see.
It just shows his continued cultural relevance, the enduring fascination with his pivotal revolutionary role. He became as much a character in the story as the artists he discovered, didn't he?
He really did. And fittingly, his passing was marked by this poignant, almost poetic, symbolic timing. It truly underscored the immense cultural significance of what he built. Sam Phillips died of respiratory failure, age 80, on July 30, 2003, in Memphis. What makes that timing so remarkable is that his death occurred only one day before the original Sun Studio was officially designated a National Historic Landmark.
Wow, one day.
One day. It's as if, just as his physical presence departed, the very physical manifestation of his vision received its highest national recognition. His passing marked the end of an era, certainly. But that landmark designation ensures his physical space, his artistic legacy, they endure. Forever enshrined as a birthplace of American music, he's interred in the Memorial Park Cemetery in Memphis, leaving behind this indelible, truly revolutionary mark on the world.
So, what does this all mean for us today? Listening back, thinking about it all, Sam Phillips wasn't just a record producer. He was, like we said, a sonic alchemist, a shrewd, visionary businessman, and a quiet, often unsung revolutionary who saw potential and beauty where others saw only boundaries, or maybe even worse, nothing at all. He was just driven by this unyielding belief in authenticity, in the power of human expression, and in the inherent worth of voices that had been historically overlooked.
Yeah, he taught us that true innovation often comes not from chasing perfection, right? But from listening intently to the mistakes. From seeking out the feel and the unexpected, and from daring to give a voice to the untamed, the raw, the unpolished. His legacy is so much more than just a catalog of hit records. It's really a profound blueprint for how a clear creative vision, coupled with astute business acumen and this deep empathetic understanding of diverse cultural expressions, how all that can fundamentally shift cultural landscapes and even courageously challenge entrenched societal norms. He didn't just record music, he amplified a revolution. A revolution that continues to echo in pretty much every song we hear today.
That's perfectly put. And it truly makes you think, doesn't it, how much one person's vision can change everything. And as we wrap up this deep dive, maybe consider this. In a world that's increasingly saturated with automation, with algorithms pushing curated perfection, with this constant drive for the flawlessly polished product, What mistakes are we overlooking today that might hold the key to the next great cultural breakthrough? What raw, unpolished feel, what authentic human expression are we maybe missing or filtering out just because we're too focused on the conventional, on the safe, on the pre-approved product? It's a question Sam Phillips answered with every groundbreaking record he ever made, and it's a question that resonates just as powerfully right now.